From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Oscar-winning director Guillermo del Toro has directed some of the wild visionary films of the past decade, Hellboy 1 and 2, and Pan's Labyrinth. The Mexican director is also the co-author of vampire novels, the Strain trilogy. The second book in the series about vampires is just out. It's called The Fall. Guillermo del Toro, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
Vampires are a well-tread area of discourse. A lot of people have been focusing on that in recent years. What were you hoping to bring to the vampires, the familiar vampire story, with your series?
Well, the reality is that for the last couple of decades, if not more, the vampire fiction has started to take a course towards mostly the passional and the melodramatic and the sort of romantic, for lack of a better word, you know, the romantic sort of bad boy of the night type of incarnation of the vampire. And it started with Anne Rice, with the polysexual vampires, an Interview with the Vampire, that were very compelling and powerful. And, you know, right now we are in the chastity phase of the myth, where vampires are defanged and neutered, so to speak, you know. And I think that what was completely forgotten for me was the vampire as a parasite, the vampire as a brutal, killing, hungry machine, you know. And vampires being really, really scary. And when I started to write the outline for the three books in 2006, right after Pan's Labyrinth, I had no idea, and frankly, Twilight had not exploded on the scene. It was not yet the vampire craze that we live in now. And, you know, I just thought it was time to bring sort of a new biological and spiritual origin for vampires, and the books try to deconstruct and reinvent that.
I don't often see novels with co-authors. Yes. You work with Chuck Hogan on this. How do you work together to write the novel?
We work, I mean, I've written 20-something screenplays, and out of those 20, I have co-written about 10. I have written fiction, and I have written a big study on Alfred Hitchcock, and I'm used to collaboration because of the screenplay discipline. Chuck, however, had never collaborated. And I made it clear from the beginning, look, you're not going to be ghostwriting stuff. You're not going to be taking dictation. We're going to be real partners. We're going to carry our weight on this, and you're going to have to be able to stand the exchange of ideas. And he said, well, we're going to try it. Let's do it. We did the first novel on a handshake. We didn't have a contract. We didn't have a publisher. And we started, and it was incredibly easy. He was very brutal with me, and I was very brutal with him. And we wrote and edited each other until the novel felt to me like one voice. And it's been pretty easy. I mean, we start, like, right now he's writing. We meet for 4 days on the beginning of every book. And in those 4 days, each calls for a chapter or this or that character, and let me write all this. And I go away and write my stuff. He goes away and writes his stuff, and we exchange pages in the middle and just rewrite and editorialize each other.
It was kind of interesting to me to see you writing a novel, because your films are so visually mind-blowing. I mean, when you were writing the novel, were you in the back of your mind maybe conceiving it of something that you would create a visual version of at some point?
I actually have made the exercise of the opposite, because the one thing I knew for certain is that any easy criticism of the novel would be, it reads like a screenplay, you know, because I am a film director and writer. And I tried to purposely, absolutely just write literature, I mean, write fiction. And, you know, I am as much a filmmaker as I am a reader and a collector of books and art. You know, I've been defined as much by books as I've been defined by films. And I really wanted to avoid even thinking. After the first novel, as of yesterday, the second novel and the first novel both have hit the top 10 in the New York Times bestseller list.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And immediately what happens is you get phone calls from TV producers, you get phone calls from movie producers wanting the rights, and we have avoided selling those rights because I don't want to think about it. I really don't want to think about it, because then you start writing more cinematically, or you start writing to appease a certain sector. And I want the novels to be unbridled in the way they approach the myth, just a fiction.
Having seen and really enjoyed your films, Hellboy, both of them, and Pan's Labyrinth, I was not that surprised to see that you were brought up pretty strictly as a Catholic in Mexico. And anyone familiar with the iconography of Catholicism in Mexico knows that it's pretty gruesome.
Yeah, I think it's second in brutality only to Filipino iconography, which is more brutal. But we have compound fractures, exposed bones, bruising. I mean, literally, it's like the CSI of Catholic imagery. You can see the entry wound of the lens and the exit wound. And, there's all sorts of morbidity associated with those images.
Well, how did a young boy brought up as a strict Catholic get into movies and into the monsters that you've created?
I was already shooting, and I was hypnotized by movies ever since I can remember. And I started making movies at age 8. And I was already drawing and painting and sculpting and exclusively monsters. I was born a little bent.
What was your first movie?
My first movie, they were just little scenes with my Planet of the Apes toys, and then I would make like a stunt ape in plasticine and fill it with ketchup and throw it from the edge of the roof and shoot it exploding in the pavement below. I don't think I have evolved much since then.
Part of your early work was as a makeup artist, and many of us remember the nightmarish face of the possessed Linda Bear in The Exorcist.
Yes.
And it was the handiwork of a makeup artist by the name of Dick Smith. He taught you.
Yes, he's one of the key figures in my life, because when I was, it took 8 years for me to do Kronos, my first movie, and I knew that no one did special effects makeup in Mexico. I was doing them in an amateur way, but I knew that for Kronos I needed to be writer, director, producer, and makeup effects head. And I wrote to him and I said, I need to take your course. He was giving a makeup course because if I don't do it, nobody will do the effects in my movie. And he was very kind, wrote me back from the start, and became a mentor. And thanks to him, I acquired the discipline and the craft of doing makeup effects at an adequate age. And sure enough, 8 years later, I do Kronos. I had not only the largest makeup effects company in Mexico, but the only one in Mexico. So, at the end of that, I closed it. And I dedicated myself solely to directing.
That was always a means to an end for you?
It was, always. And I love sculpting, I love illustrating, but I do think that it's a very difficult craft. I am very sympathetic to the people that do it, because most of the time your stuff gets ruined by the cinematographer or the director, because they don't shoot it well. You do all this work, and then they overlight it, underlight it, or not showcase it properly.
Having done it yourself, Guillermo del Toro, do you kind of wander over to the makeup area on your sets to offer your advice on maybe you should be this or that?
Yes, I am a nuisance. And there's nothing that gets me. And my wife was with me in the shop in Mexico, and when we come to a makeup effects shop and we smell cooking latex, or we smell the curing fiberglass, we get a tingle and a little tear in our eyes,
Guillermo del Toro is my guest, the award-winning Mexican director of Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy 1 and 2. We're at 206-543-5869 if you've got a question or a comment for Guillermo del Toro. I want to talk a little bit about monsters. You've talked a lot about how monsters fascinate you, and one of the quotes that I heard you say was fascinating. They fascinate you in part because they're beautiful and fragile. Two things that I don't associate with monsters. Why are they beautiful and fragile to you?
They depend on, good monsters are incredibly hard to create, because you essentially are inventing an entire biology. You are inventing a genus. You're inventing a family. You have to really put it in front of an audience, and for them to don't think the monster is outlandish enough not to be real. It needs to be real, but it doesn't need to be so real that it's boring. It's a very delicate balance. And what I do normally is in creating the monster, I am already thinking about the jacking up the visual design of the movie, camera style, color, production design, because I always say that movies are like terrariums that you create for a particular type of lizard, for example. And for that lizard to exist there, you need to put some sand, and you need to put some rocks, and you need to put a light that simulates the sun. It's the same with a monster. The movie is the terrarium, stylistically, for the monster to exist, for people to believe it. I remember when we were shooting Mimic in 1997, Bob Weinstein was furious because the dailies of the movie were a little too hyper. We were in a hospital ward with glowing tents. And he said, "Where is that hospital?" I said, "New York." He said, "No, what planet? There's nothing like that in New York." I said, "Well, there's also no giant roaches in New York, no 6 foot tall human roaches. So, you know, if you want those creatures to exist in a movie, you cannot just shoot a straight Sidney Lumet New York. You have to jack up the style." So that's what the fragility I talk about. The other thing they require is belief and devotion. You know, you need to truly love them to create them well. Because this is, I think that when you go to a church, the supreme craftsmanship for me are not the saints carved in the pillars. You know, it's the gargoyle speaking from the edge. Because this came out straight from the imagination of the artist. There is no model, there is no impositions. They're free, you know, they are grotesqueries that are absolutely elaborate and beautiful. And that's what I refer to with the beauty and the fragility.
As the father of two, you certainly can appreciate the real scary things there are in life.
Yes.
What's the appeal of creating screen frightening things, both for you and, you think, for the audience?
I think that we are a culture, I mean, we are a race that is, the human race is a physical animal race, of course. We are mammalians, we are this and we are that, but we are also spiritual creatures. And we need representational, totemic, talismanic things to work, and storytelling is one of them. You know, you articulate the cosmology, you articulate these creatures, angels and demons and monsters, in order to make sense of the world that surrounds you. And, you know, if we negate the dark side of life, namely death, aging, decomposition, frailty, morbidity, all those things, we are living to an impossible standard as a race. And the only thing that reminds you, I remember in the refectories in convents, there, before you enter the dining room, above the door, there was a rotting skeleton carved in stone that said "Memento Mori." You know, and it was essentially telling the monks that were about to have their earthly delights with the repast in the dining room, it was telling them, remember, you are dead flesh. And I think that darkness and entertaining movies in the genre sort of put us back in touch with things that socially we have completely isolated.
You are, let's go to Tracy. She's calling us today from Bellevue with a question for you. Good afternoon, Tracy.
My question was about, what was about Pan's Labyrinth. And I know that the character of, I guess it was the captain in that movie, was such a dark, evil character. And he really was darker than any of the monsters in that movie. So do you feel sometimes that human nature can be a little scarier than your monsters?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I actually make it a point. I recommend the two movies I've done that I like the most are a movie called Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth. And they are sister and brother movies. They are siblings. If you like Pan's Labyrinth, give it a try. And in both movies and in many other movies I do, I try to demonstrate that monsters are actually the nice creatures. And in Devil's Backbone, which is a ghost story, the ghost is a pitiful little figure. And there's a proto-fascist character in the story that is scarier than him. And the captain in Pan's Labyrinth is designed to be the monster, really, in the movie. And this leads me to one of the things I fear the most. I fear the most people that seek perfection. I am very, very afraid of people that seek perfection or enthroned perfection. And I'm even more scared of people that say there is only one truth, and that truth becomes law. And therefore, a fascist officer in post-war Spain that was in charge of exterminating any rebellion is one of the scariest figures. But if you see the movie and Devil's Backbone, both villains are incredibly handsome, incredibly magnetic. In the case of the captain, he's so polished, always well-groomed, always impeccably dressed, and he gets up when his wife enters a room or any lady enters a room. He's a gentleman fascist. This perfection, this sort of learned behavior into looking good and always regimented into perfection is so scary to me.
Hey, Tracy, thanks a lot for your phone call.
Thank you.
You're in the early stages of making a film of Frankenstein, and you have said that the best moments in the novel have never been filmed.
It is true. Let me give you a tiny example. One of my favorite moments in the novel is the moment where Victor goes to sleep, exhausted after the creation of the monster. And he wakes up to find the creature balefully looking at him from the foot of the bed. And it's a moment of enormous, raw, scary power. And the moment has never been filmed like that. You know, and it was scripted like that by Frank Darabont for the Kenneth Branagh Frankenstein, but I think the movie became more concerned with showcasing Kenneth Branagh's a six-pack in his abs and his lubricated torso than it became out at the moment. But it's fortunately never been shot like that.
We're just about out of time, but now you have kids. Are they of age where they have started to try to make films also?
Well, no, they are very good artists, both of my daughters. They are very good draft women, I would say. And they love drawing creatures, I'm very happy to report.
Guillermo del Toro, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you speaking with us
today.
My pleasure. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.